Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. Today we're hitting the London stage for this month's theatre review, and joining me here in the studio is the critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ben. It's nice to be here.
Now, the unlikely subject of the first stage production we're discussing today is sewing. But Matt, I presume that it runs a little deeper than a group of women with needles and thread. Tell us about the sewing group.
Well, it's a play by Evie Crow, who's a World Court playwright that theater's done a lot to nurture. A lot of her plays in the past have involved children. This does not. It is deceptive, because what you think it is in fact what it isn't. So when it begins, you think it's about, as you say, a community of women in the 1700s, all dressed in sort of Puritan garb, stitching away quietly. The scenes are frustratingly abbreviated, punctuated by blackouts, irritating sort of noise as each scene changes. And then as time goes on, you realize that it isn't that at all. There's a point beyond which, though, Ben, I can't really say what it is, because then that would give away the pleasure of seeing it. But it's what we like to call a puzzle play. It's a trick. And I think your response to it depends entirely on whether you buy the trick, whether you go with it, or whether you think, wait a minute. And I'm afraid I was in the wait a minute category. I didn't think that the build up to it merited the payoff.
Just your review of that just now sounds cryptic enough. So I'm guessing that watching this was a little bit like, I suppose, watching a stage version of a crossword puzzle.
Oh, that's a very good analogy. I like that. Yeah, excellent. Yes, I mean, what one can say is that the sewing group isn't, in fact, a sewing group, that it is a acted endeavor as opposed to a lived endeavor, and that perhaps it isn't quite taking place when you think it's taking place. And beyond that, my lips are sealed.
Wow, that actually sounds truly fascinating. So even though there is, in this non-sewing group, that is ostensibly a sewing group, there is actual sewing taking place.
Oh, yeah. And I would love to know whether the actresses had to go to special needlepoint class in order to, deliver, because that is what they are doing for the first, 10, 20 minutes of the play, and you can't fake it. And the other thing about the Royal Court Theatre upstairs is that it's very intimate, so you can't hide. If you're a non-sewer, your incapacity is going to be writ large, or should I say sewn large.
Well, as I was reading about this, I learned that when they were beginning to rehearse this play, that they actually had to spend about 90 minutes every day just sewing together. That was just part of their rehearsals.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. And the other thing, of course, that allows, regardless of the actual stitch work, is for an incredible concentration. And that is actually the most interesting part of the first half of it, is they're all being very quiet. Why? And then we find out.
Mm. Oh, it sounds quite fascinating. That is the sewing group, which it may or may not be an actual sewing group, but it most definitely is on at the Royal Court Theatre.
It is a play.
It is indeed a play, and it's on until the 23rd of December. Now, Matt, we'll move on, but we're staying at the Royal Court Theatre, actually, for our second show today, and it's The Children. Yeah. It tells the story of two retired nuclear scientists called Hazel and Robin, who live in an isolated cottage by the sea. Now, as the world around them starts to fall apart, they remain together until an old friend arrives with a certain request that shakes up their world. Matt, how do the children that the title refers to come into this story?
Well, that's the absolutely opposite question, because in contrast with the sewing group, which gives its title to something that isn't actually it, the children is the title of a play that contains, and this isn't a spoiler, it doesn't contain any children. So it's interesting that the two complement one another in that way. But what you do have, as you've described it, are these women, one of whom is part of a married couple, that's the brilliant Deborah Finlay, and the other of whom is a long-lost friend stroke colleague, the equally brilliant Francesca Annis. And the Deborah Finlay character is married to Ron Cook, and they have children who you hear quite a bit about. And what you hear about them is important. You need to listen to that. And the Francesca Annis character has no children. And that's also important because, as you might imagine from a play that involves nuclear engineering and that is taking place next to an unspecified nuclear disaster, or the results of same, And we can think of all sorts of contemporary parallels that the playwright might be alluding to. Issues of legacy, bequest, what sort of world you want to pass on are clearly going to be very important. So the children of the title become a symbol really for the after effect, the afterlife, the aftershock, as it were, of something as seismic as a nuclear meltdown.
So this is all very post-apocalyptic, and that's obviously the world that we're being taken to here. How is that presented on the stage?
Yeah, but what's really brilliant about this play, which is by, it should be pointed out, the young writer of, Lucy Kirkwood, young writer of a very popular play from a couple of years ago called Chimerica, to which this play is totally, totally different. That play was a kind of vast sort of intellectually and geographically sprawling play about Chinese-American relations. This is set in one particular English rural home, and it never leaves that home. So to answer your question, it isn't, it doesn't feel sci-fi. It doesn't feel kind of like you've landed in a Kubrick movie or something. It's actually quite quotidian. The emphasis is on kind of the detail of, well, let's have a cup of tea, and, you know, when you go to the loo, just make sure that, you know, you dispose of your waste properly, and kind of bizarrely quotidian, actually. That second example I just gave is actually quite important to the play. Waste is an important theme in the play. So what I think Lucy Kirkwood is getting at is the way in which, in so much of life, particularly in this extreme situation, these kind of macrocosmic incidents happen, but yet we remain individuals who have our daily concerns, like, you know, can I have a glass of water? Well, maybe you can't if there's just been this sort of thing. So the way in which the two worlds jostle up against each other, I thought it was really, really terrific. It's almost 2 hours, no interval. It's very, very pacey. And particularly the two women, Francesca Annis and Deborah Finley, are both at the absolute top of their game. And it's a little bit of a puzzle play, the way The Sewing Group is, but that's a puzzle play in terms of the plot. The plot changes gears. With this one, it's not so much that the plot changes gears, it's that the characters' motivations are kind of elusive until the end. Why is the Francesca Annis character actually there? What does she want? And we find out, of course, before it's over.
And you can find out by popping along to see The Children. That's on at the Royal Court Theatre until the 14th of January. Now we head to the Noel Coward Theatre here in London for Half a Sixpence. It's an adaptation of the musical that was first staged in the 1960s. Based upon the semi-autobiographical novel Kipps, The Story of a Simple Soul. Matt, tell us about what's going on here.
Well, this is what they like to call a revisal, which is this sort of newish term, which talks about revivals of shows where in the doing of the reviving, they've revised something about it. And this happens a lot. We've probably talked about it before, maybe. But the revisal aspect of it here, and I obviously was too young, not for much, but too young to have seen the original version, is that the original score has been buttressed by a whole bunch of new songs by the contemporary songwriting team of George Stiles and Anthony Drew, who are great favorites, deservedly, they're very talented, of Sir Cameron Mackintosh, the producer. So you've got the original score, which includes, you know, very celebrated songs like a standard of the 60s called Flashbang Wallop, which I guess is the big second act kind of humdinger. And then you've got a lot of new songs, only one of which really announces itself as a keeper. But it's a peculiar piece, although perhaps it chimes with the times. It's one of these pieces. In your intro, you talked about simplicity and the adjective simple. It's a show that places a great, great value on that. It's a world, it's Kent around 1911, where nothing is supposed to be too complicated. And we've got our kind of sweet-faced, very energetic, fresh young hero played brilliantly by the newcomer Charlie Stemp, who's clearly got a huge future. And he comes into money, and all of a sudden that changes his life. But even though it changes his financial fortunes, will it change the girl he loves? Will it change his social class? And the answer to all of these is a very emphatic no. And one of the strange things about the show is that it's written by, again, the book has been tweaked by Gillian Fellowes of Downton Abbey fame. And it seems to suggest the theme of the piece would seem to be that really, no matter what your circumstances, you should know your place and remain there. And there's a very odd feeling in the piece that the classes are ironclad. You don't move between them. If you move between them, you're sort of doomed to failure. And also, Kent 1911 in this show has sort of strange parallels with much of England in 2016. For instance, we're told, you know, it's of course all very white. That I guess goes without saying. We're told that, you know, moule marinière and anything foreign, and, you know, not good to kind of be sophisticated. And one thinks now about the anti-elite sentiments at large. And I came out of it thinking, A, that it was a little on the reactionary side, and B, that it was absolutely the show for our Brexiteering moment. There's even a character in the show, and I'm sure this is no accident, called Lady Dacre. And, you know, Paul Dacre is the last name of the, is the editor of the Daily Mail. So I don't think that's an accident. It's that pointed.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, so that actually quite surprises me, because this has attracted quite a lot of praise, this revisal, as you call it. But, I mean, picking up on some of those messages that you've picked out there, it's unsurprising that it would be attempting to be somewhat contemporary in the messages that it gets across. But I'm confused by some of those messages that it is getting across, because coming from the arts, the world of the arts at least, there have been very strong messages about diversity and inclusiveness and anti-hate. That doesn't seem to chime in very well with this message of as you put it, the classes are ironclad and don't move between them.
Well, let's not get, I mean, I don't want to get too carried away. Anti-hate and that whole rhetoric is not part of this show. That this show is meant to be pure escapism, but it's meant to be pure escapism in that nostalgic appeal way that, you know, a lot of the Brexit movement was about, hearkening back to a halcyon England before we were troubled by all sorts of things, which the show doesn't name. I don't think the show sees itself as at all political, but it's interesting the way in which, this happens all the time, things in the popular culture pick up on the zeitgeist of the age. So I think that's what I'm saying, is that perhaps without announcing it, it seems to participate in the zeitgeist of the age. And, you know, that mainstream, middle-class, possibly non-London audience that comes into the West End, what they like to call the carriage trade, I'm sure they'll have a flashbang wallop of a time. And because Charlie Stemp, who's 22, 23, young guy, he's done one or two things before. He was in Wicked, but this is his first major part. And he's terrific, and it really is a kind of Star Is Born moment. So you can have a great time watching him, and perhaps best not to think too deeply about the rest of it. Treat it simply, which is to belong to the landscape of the piece.
That's a very eloquent way of putting, summarizing your thoughts on that, Matt. That is Half a Sixpence. It's on at the Noel Coward Theatre until April the 22nd. And finally today, The Last 5 Years. It's another musical, but this time set in New York, where a couple named Kathy and Jamie fall in love during half a decade. This is just about to come to the end of its run, Matt. But is it worth catching for all of our listeners?
Yeah, it's worth clamoring for tickets if you like musicals and if you like Jason Robert Brown, who's the American composer of the piece, who also directed this production. So you really feel the authenticity of it because, you know, it's not that customary to have the composer of a show also being its own director. It's a show I've seen quite a few times before in other iterations. It was made into a movie a couple of years ago with Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan, which admittedly wasn't seen by that many people. But it's you know, just structurally, it's infinitely more challenging than the likes of Half a Sixpence would ever want to be. That they're not really, you know, they're apples and oranges, because the structure of The Last 5 Years is that Kathy, the female half of the equation, her story is told in reverse, from the point at which she and Jamie have broken up backwards to the point at which her love for him is just beginning, whereas his story is told going forward. So they only actually meet at the halfway point, where they go in the show on a very romantic sort of consolidating date.
But other than that, somewhat discombobulating, because a narrative structure like that can sometimes, I mean, to introduce something like that may sound interesting on paper, but in practice it can be just a little bit of a gimmick.
Yeah, you might think so, or it can be kind of too tricksy by half, but actually in this case it's very emotional, because what you're seeing is a constant kind of point counterpoint. So she's at a point of despair because it's all ended. He's at a point of excitement and breathless anticipation. And by the end, they've swapped over. And it's kind of neatly gauged. So whereas I think if it were just all straightforward, it might be a little too much of a wallow in whatever. But here it gives it a constant astringency because you're always setting A against B, B against A. And it also provides, I think, an interesting acting challenge for the two terrific terrific performers in it, Jonathan Bailey, Johnny Bailey, and the wonderful Samantha Barks, who some people may know from the movie of Les Mis, who has a fantastic voice. My God, she can really deliver a tune. Because they're two, it's a two-hander, but essentially for each of them, it's a solo play. So even though they're more or less on stage, you know, pretty much passing the baton throughout 90 minutes, they really have to deliver to the audience entirely with minimal contact with the other. So it's a great challenge. And they just do it very beautifully. And it's quite well sustained in the acting, not just the singing. So you really do feel as if you're watching two dual journeys.
Fantastic. That's the last 5 years. It's running at the St. James Theatre here in London until December the 3rd. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guest, Matt Wolfe. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. The producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our book review with the writer Mark Mason. But for now, thanks for listening, and bye-bye.